Let's do the 60-second savings challenge. Step one, download Rocket Money. Step two, link your accounts and see every subscription you're paying for. Tap one you don't use and cancel it. That's money back every month. Step three, create a financial goal. $50 every paycheck, or let the app automatically move small amounts of cash when you can afford it. In a week, you'll forget you set it up. In a month, you'll see real dollars piling up. In a year, you'll be shocked at how much money you've saved. Bonus challenge, upload an internet or phone bill and let Rocket Money try to lower it. You only pay if they find you savings. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. Make saving money the resolution you actually keep. Start the 60-second savings challenge at rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might not have heard last week, or news that you did hear but didn't hear from this perspective. Make sure you join our community on Instagram at Pod Save the People, and here we go. Hey, this is Duray, and welcome to Pod Save the People. In this episode, it's me, Miles, and Sharonda talking about the news with regard to race, justice, and equity that you might not have heard last week, or news that you did hear but didn't hear from this perspective. Make sure you join our community on Instagram at Pod Save the People, and here we go. We are recording on Mother's Day. It's great to be back. This is Duray at D-R-A-Y on Twitter.
This is Miles E. Johnson. At miles.e.johnson, I think, on Instagram. But it's all crumbling. You don't got to follow me. Follow God.
And this is Sharonda Bossier at BossierS on Spill.
Now, since we last recorded, the Met Gala happened. It had not happened when we recorded. Did you all have standout outfits? Or was there any, you know, we had a conversation about the political significance or insignificance of the Met Gala before it happened. Have those views changed since it happened?
I thought Janelle Monáe was best dressed. That was my vote. I think I was a little disappointed by how safely everyone played it. I think I was looking for like people to kind of wow me. And it's not that people didn't look great. I thought people looked great. It just felt like people were not taking risks. Even Coleman Domingo, who I think is beautiful, and like I always look forward to what he wears, felt like he was outdressed by his husband to me. I'm not a fashionista. Y'all please don't start pulling my pictures online talking about, but look, you wore this in public, right? But I was hoping that we would see people be a little bit more innovative and sort of push Black dandyism into the future. And I don't think I saw a lot of that from the looks I saw.
Yeah, I was kind of shocked how much I didn't like it. Like, usually I have more of a struggle because usually I'm really seduced by beautiful things and fashionable moments, but there was no seduction. The moment that I saw going viral of Coleman Domingo with Anna Wintour gazing at the Black Choir, again, it just seems like we're in this era where these kind of like minstrel, odd, absurdist imagery is just really easy to produce. And, you know, sometimes, listen, my blanket comes wet, so I'm used to feeling certain types of ways. I was surprised at how many people I was seeing on the internet from different Black people from different walks of life commenting on the Met Gala. So one of the ones I wanted to read was by at Miss Belladonic on X. They say, thinking about the peoples all over the world who have to constantly rebuild their lives because of the U.S. militarism, which the Met and the Gala's founders support, do they not have culture and histories worthy of preservation and celebration? And they go on to talk about the Met Gala as an institution that helped harm Black people and how we're celebrating it and how often our celebration can cloak the actual indictment or critique of institutions like the Met Gala. I was really interested. That was just one that I pulled, but I was really interested in those different critiques. Even when I was watching Funky Dineva, was like, what are we doing this, y'all? And, you know, I kind of think about the personality, but I also think about who the personality talks to. Funky Dineva's audience is middle-aged, to older auntie Black women. A lot of these other people are younger 20s, 30s folks who I would call inside of the cultural academic conversation. And then I just saw some other people who just weren't swayed with it. And, you know, with my eyes and seeing Coleman Domingo's fine ass just a gazing and smirking within a winter, I'm like, yeah, that does kind of cut. You know, it does feel like we've gotten so far in 2025, but we're still recreating these images that are disempowering and filled with just this toxic amount of respectability that has gotten Black people nowhere.
It is interesting. You know, we all watch it together. Everybody is tweeting it, people on Instagram, people on Threads. And I remember the first Met Gala I paid attention to was during the protests because, you know, it was like we had been in the street for a long time and then the Met Gala comes. And then I had a critique of the power dynamic. But I remember also being like, wow, this is really beautiful and da-da-da. And I do think there's a limit to how many years you can just see priceless dresses and suits. You're like, okay, I saw it. I got it. You're like, da 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 da. And, you know, people gave AOC grief for the Eat the Rich dress, but I at least appreciated sort of some political message. The only overtly political message that seemed to appear this one is the one that they had to disavow. Do you remember the woman who they said had Rosa Parks on her crotch? Do you remember that?
I remember that.
It was like, and then they were like, it's not, I mean, thank God it wasn't Rosa Parks on our crotch, but you're like, I was actually shocked that there was nobody attempting to make sort of a political message in this moment. Like none of the outfits, I guess Teyana Taylor's outfit, I guess, I don't know, but.
That's one thing I liked about it.
That it wasn't.
Yeah, I think just stop it. Cause I'm like it's you know what you're making money for, you know how much the tables are, you know the institutions you're getting money for, you know what you're using your Black cool, your Black beauty for. You're using it to further on the empire. Everybody's kissing Anna Wintour's feet. Do not pretend to say something political or radical just so you can get some brownie points on the internet who won't give a fuck in 2 days. Just go ahead and be a Sambo.
Ooh. Ooh, well, now.
Sorry. Is Sambo a curse word? I thought that was me trying not to say the raccoon word.
Well, when I saw Saquon Barkley's outfit, I was like, you know, this is one we can give back. We can trade him in the
racial draft.
In the racial draft, he can go. You know, it's been interesting. We didn't talk about this last week, but there's been a lot of conversation about Luigi. And, you know, he's raised a ton of money. His trial is seemingly coming up. I don't know if you saw, but they had been listening to phone calls of him and his lawyer in jail. So that there's this whole legal drama of that because that is illegal. It's been interesting how long the celebration of Luigi has been as somebody who is pushing back on the system and who is righteous in their anger about something unjust. And Luigi made me think about the most recent case that has hit the news around policing, Rodney Hinton Jr., who is being charged with intentionally hitting and killing an Ohio sheriff's deputy with a car after his son, Ryan Hinton, who was 18 years old, was fatally shot by the police. Now, all reports say that Ryan Hinton was running away from the police officers when he was shot. The police are saying that that he pointed a gun at them. We don't know what is going on with that investigation, but, you know, it is all over the place. The police showed up in droves to the father's hearing and seemed to be threatening him by having all of the police show up in just in force like that. It was really interesting to see. But the accounts of the son being killed is that the Cincinnati police say they got a report of a stolen car at the condos and four teenagers got out of it and started running. Within 6 seconds, an unidentified officer fired 4 to 5 shots, hitting Hinton twice and ultimately killing him. The officer says Hinton turned to point his gun at him as he fled between two dumpsters. Now, the family is saying this literally didn't happen. He was running away, da-da-da. But That's what happened. I bring it here because it's interesting to see the way people talk about Luigi and juxtaposed to the way that people talk about Ryan Hinton Sr. Obviously, very different cases. And the officer who Ryan Hinton Sr. Hit was not the officer who shot his son. But I wanted to bring it here because people have been talking about it. People have been sending messages about it. We did not talk about it last week. I want to know what you all think.
I think people understood Luigi killing the healthcare executive as being a statement about the structural violence of health insurance and the denial of health insurance and health coverage for people in the United States. I think in the case of Hinton, you know, police officers have done a good job of individualizing their assessment of risk, right? And I don't think people understand Hinton's actions as also being a reaction to structural or systemic violence, right? And so they're like, this police officer did not do anything, right? And like, for all we know, the United Healthcare CEO also hadn't done anything that personally impacted Luigi, right? But people understood that as a statement about a system or a structure. And people are seemingly having a hard time understanding Hinton's actions similarly. I also think that people are missing that Hinton's actions are deeply rooted in grief, right? And like, I don't know what you do when you lose your child in that way, right? And like, I feel like there are never, in most people's eyes, legitimate reasons for Black people to ever use violence or to respond with violence, right? And I think what people are struggling with in this moment is that people seem to have liked this police officer, right? He was so close to retirement. There are all these stories about who he was as a person, and that divorces him from his like representation as this broader systemic or structural thing that I think Hinton was actually reacting and responding to.
It seems like the police have a better PR apparatus than UnitedHealthcare, right? So I think that they're a little bit more prepared for moments like this. I think the Luigi moment was a little bit more of a surprise and just less packed with history and context already. We know most people know the story around Black folks and police, and whereas I feel like the Luigi moment let us enter a new story in a different way. The other thing, too, is it really depends on who you're asking, because the Black men who I've been speaking to and who I've not been speaking to, because, you know, I'm in Ohio, y'all. So, like, I'm hearing so many conversations around this moment, and they seem pretty clear on what's going on. They seem pretty activated about what's going on. And this is kind of the same thing I was saying around the Lincoln Heights incident. This is the same thing that I've been saying around even when we think about Black men and going to college and those articles coming out, that there is a political moment that nobody's meeting when it comes to a lot of Black people, and specifically when it comes to Black men. And it's a cultural and political moment that is just such a wide gap. And to me, this illustrates it to me, because that man's reaction, Lincoln Heights, those folks' reaction was protection, vengeance, and violence, right? No matter how you feel about it, it was no more moral Democrat, Republican, let's wait incremental bullshit. It was, you do this to my son, I'm coming for you, and my life is already a nothing. So I'd rather my life literally turn into nothing via prison or via death, knowing that I honored my son. That's where Black people are at. That's where a lot of poor Black people are at. And if we're not even attempting to kind of create language that meets them in that rage, might as well call it off now.
It is interesting, too, because, you know, the last decade, and I think about myself as this is the work that I do around police accountability. The last decade, we have been told about accountability systems, and we're changing policies and laws. And, you know, it looks like there's a lot of momentum. And then you watch Tyre Nichols get killed on camera. Tyre Nichols did nothing in Memphis. And then you watch the officers get acquitted, and you're like, you know, what do you tell people? Mm-hmm. Like, what do you say in that moment? You say, you know, file a lawsuit, the DA got you, da-da-da-da. You tell them all these things. And with Tyre, there's no other story. There's no different version. We watched it. Even, you know, George Floyd, Derek Chauvin did get convicted. He is serving a sentence. I don't know if you all heard, but there's a rumor going around that Trump is going to pardon Chauvin,
Oh, I had not heard
during
that.
Police week. Yeah, this is the rumor. You know, the only thing I have to say to that is that Trump really does want chaos in the streets so he can call the National Guard. Remember, if Chauvin gets pardoned by Trump, he still was convicted by the state of Minnesota and he did not have overlapping sentences. So if he gets released from federal custody, he will immediately begin his state custody. Mm-hmm. So just remember that Trump is playing us. But even with George Floyd, still today, there are people who are like, Derek Chauvin didn't kill him. They're like, he died because he had high blood pressure and mm-hmm. used drugs. And you're like, mm-hmm. what? Yeah, so mm-hmm. The Hinton case, I think you're right, Miles. I think that there are a whole set of people who participated in what they were told for a long time. And they were like, yep, I'm going to do it. And then that failed. And they are thinking about other options. And that is, I think, where we are.
Yes. But I think the thing I want to illustrate even deeper is that there is a lot of people who never participated in that. So there are people who are poor, people who are born into certain types of ideas around what happens when you come and disrespect me, who had never invested in these kind of paradigms of right and wrong, who are now, we're beginning to see actions that maybe portray, I really don't know how to say it. It just seems as though there's a certain type of new moral compass that's surfacing from people who maybe never cared about this system, never found themselves invested in it morally. Does that make, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not going to get their justice, so I'm going to get mine.
But it's not an awakening. Like, that to me feels different. That to me feels different to me.
Miles, let me just circle back.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned, there's more to come.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Now, mental health awareness is growing, but there's a lot of progress to be made. I can tell you, when I was growing up, it was really taboo to talk about going to therapy or getting help to process the world around you. People sort of felt like it was a sign of strength to just tough it out on your own and like plow through. And I'm happy that that is not the case today, that people have a much richer conversation and understanding of mental health awareness and that therapy is something that people embrace. But there is still a lot of work to be done. 26% of Americans who participated in a recent survey said that they've avoided seeking mental health support due to fear of judgment. We got to change that, and you can be the beginning of changing that. This Mental Health Awareness Month, let's encourage everyone to take care of their well-being and break the stigma. The world is better when people are healthy and happy. And let me tell you, therapy was a game changer for me. In 2020 is when I really started therapy in earnest, and I was just dealing with a lot of stuff, and I needed a place to go to process all of it, and therapy really was a game changer in the sense that I had somebody who was not a part of my day-to-day life who was able to help me process the life that I was living. You know, it really was one of those things that I didn't fully appreciate until I was in it, so I cannot recommend therapy enough. And that's what I'm here to tell you about BetterHelp. BetterHelp has over 10 years of experience matching people with the right therapist from their diverse network of more than 30,000 licensed therapists with a wide range of specialties. BetterHelp is fully online, and that makes therapy affordable and convenient, and they serve over 5 million people worldwide. It's easy to switch therapists at any time at no extra cost, and this is a great pathway if you want to start therapy today. We're all better with help. Visit betterhelp.com/people to get 10% off your first month. That's betterhelp, HELP.com/people. I don't know if you've seen too, but Mayor Pete has been making the rounds on the podcast circuit. I think he's been an effective communicator in a landscape of real challenges around communication on the left. And then, you know, Trump is asked about Mayor Pete and delivers just one simple homophobic sentence that, you know, very much played to the base, where he said about Mayor Pete, he, quote, has no clue. You know, he drives to work on his bicycle with his, in all fairness, with his husband on his back. And you're like, well, Trump, what are we doing with you, man? So I wanted to bring up Mayor Pete here. He has been making the rounds on the right, certainly on the left. What are y'all thoughts about Mayor Pete's recent forays in the press and Trump?
I think I hope this is not just a dream. That means life is getting really crazy. But I think I already discussed Andrew Scholes and Pete and how much and how off the mark I thought that was, and how I'm just not a Pete Buttigieg believer like I see a lot of other people are. I'm just not a believer in that way. I don't think a gay man is going to get elected. I don't think that this is what the moment's looking for. And I think it's all about that identity. And I think that what's so interesting, though, to me, just to, I guess, work on top of that Andrew Scholes critique temper tantrum, was now you did all this stuff. You sat down with somebody who made a rape joke about a black man, and you sat down, you grew your beard out, you're talking about going to Iraq, and you did all this to make it seem like you had bigger balls and you're more alike than these people, than you are different. And in two sentences, Trump just unravels all of that. So more than likely, you were never going to gain those voters anyway. But there was any leeway, any legitimacy that this kind of whole, this tour inside of the manosphere was doing for Pete, it was just unraveled in two sentences. And what I think is funny and interesting about Trump's homophobia in this moment is this is the homophobia that neoliberal fascism lands you on, because it is quiet, it's subtle, it's, I'm not homophobic, but it paints this picture that really is the foundation of what makes most straight homophobic people uncomfortable around gayness. It's just the sitting on two bikes going down the street together. Just something about it just makes me feel, He just tapped on that. But if you just write it out, it's not the most homophobic thing you ever heard. I probably said more homophobic things in a gay club at 6 a.m. before. It's not the wildest thing you ever heard, but it really just, it's actually just quite masterful in just making you uncomfortable enough with the imagery enough. And what it also says is, your next president cannot be riding a two-seater bicycle with no man. That's just not the America you stand for. And that, to me, is the message. And yeah. So I hope it was worth it, Pete.
The only thing I will add, because it is the funniest thing I've heard in a long time, and I really hate that it came out of Trump's mouth, was, which is a nice, loving relationship. And there was something about that that truly did me in. And I think to Miles's point, it was because of the subtle homophobia in it, right? It was the, like, you know, I respect his choice. I'm a little grossed out by it, but, like, you know, I don't know. When I watched that clip, I was like, this man is just, he's so good. And I think one of the things that I feel like I did in the first go round was sort of, at least in the early stages of his campaign in the during the Republican primary, did not understand just how strategic he was about playing into the, like, y'all think I'm harmless and a little bit of an idiot, right? But those, like, insidious kinds of jokes, right? The, like, which is a nice loving relationship, one of my uncles would say. You know what I mean? And it's just like, that is the thing that he's really good at. And I think some of my, like, honestly, like, laughter was like, man, holy shit, I know this landed with people I know, you know?
Yeah, I do think Pete has a chance. I think he's a great communicator. I don't know if I love him being on. Andrew Scholes was just a real misstep to me. I was like, bro, this is not good. But I think in the landscape of the party, I think that Pete has a bright future, and I think he could win. I actually think that Pete could win. I think that the way Trump is homophobic, like you both said, it lands in a way that people can say, like, oh, no, I still like gay people. And that is...
So, let's just be real.
What's up, Miles?
And let's talk. And if you know a black person, listen, if you're a white person, close your ears or keep this between us. You think that enough black people would vote for an openly gay man in 2028, specifically knowing who and what age and what church-going demographic is the most loyal to the Democratic Party? You think that that he has a chance, for real?
I do, yeah. I think they would not vote for anyone else but a white gay man. I think if a gay person will win, I think it will be a white gay man.
Then I think you should run in 2028, because I think you have a better chance. Then you, we need to get you off this podcest and get this right.
Who is mask presenting? Yeah, I think that, you know, a lot. I know some people. Yeah, I don't know. I think if a gay person would win, I think it'd be a mask presenting white man.
No, I don't even know if I feel like he could win statewide office. Right? Like, I think, Like, there are just pockets of people
I'm getting ganged up on in the podcast, y'all.
Deeply uncomfortable by the, like, made deeply, deeply uncomfortable by the idea. And then, like, I've got to do what? I've got to look at him on the trail with his husband and their kids. I've got to explain to my kids where those kids came from. I got to explain to my kids that some people have two daddies.
This is why we're talking about on the podcast. We got time.
we need time, like 20 years.
Listen.
Listen.
The only reason I wanted to bring this home, like my like disbelief in this, is because I don't think if we're going to ever see a Democratic Party in the next, or a Democratic officer in power in the next, like, let's say 16 years, like, I just don't think we could ignore the reasons that maybe feel too simple or too flat as to why Vice President Harris didn't become in office. And I think we did, I'm not just like us, the three of us, but just people in general said, well, it's about money. It's about economy. Nuance, nuance, nuance. That's the new N-word. Like, I get that. But there was also some heavy identity politics that just weren't cleared. That also helped her fail. And I think us ignoring how much that informs people's victory is just, it feels a little dangerous.
I might get it. Shout out to Shedeur Sanders, who, you know, they played in the NFL. He was a fifth round pick, and he not only had the number one selling jersey, but he is the promo for the NFL right now. They tweeting about him. They can't stop talking about Shedeur. And they did all of that. And I love how great Deion has trained his sons to deal with the media. Like, they just are like on it, and I love it. It's just such a good thing to watch.
And speaking of Shedeur, right, like, one of the things that I saw this week was that a fan is suing the NFL claiming, like, emotional distress because they were so invested in Shador's success and him getting drafted early, et cetera. And it's just a really interesting thing, I think, to think about a young fan feeling that connected to a player, like having that kind of parasocial relationship, so much so that they feel like they should go and sue the NFL to be like, not only did you play in his face, but you played in mine. And I am seeking the requisite compensation so that I can be made whole as a result. But I think what's also interesting is in a culture where, you know, for a lot of people, professional athletes become almost like gods to us, what's going to happen to Shedeur as he continues to play? And to your point, as he figures out how to better leverage the media and control the narrative around who he is, his early experiences in the NFL, like, is this going to be like Shedeur will be the ultimate sort of NFL phoenix, you know, rising from the ashes of being a fifth round draft pick? But yeah, I thought the idea that a fan would say, I feel, you know, so harmed by the NFL doing this to a player that I'm seeking damages was really interesting to me.
Or like a little stupid though too, right? Like that's like cold word for a little goofy. a little goofy, a little, right? I don't get it, y'all. I don't understand. I really, really don't get it. And the more, so I was watching this. Oh, I wish I could remember who it was. I think it might have been like the Waving the Red Flag podcast, which I really like. I'm trying to do better at just naming the people who I enjoy. So I think it might be that podcast, but if it's not, I'm sorry. But, you know, just straight dudes talking who have some sense. And I feel like one of them even talked about the parallels between what happens in football and what happened in chattel slavery, and this kind of like weird, just this weird place football finds you in, and the ownership of it all, you know. And as somebody who only who's not a fan of football, who's not a fan of sports, but who understands how it works, and hearing these other Black men talk about how uncomfortable it makes them, the idea that although it might be a high payday, there are just white companies, white billionaires, white wealthy people who are sensibly saying what is the cost for your life? What's the cost for your health? What's the cost for your body? And people give it to them, and people give them that cost. And something about it just makes me feel icky. And again, I'll say it again, I don't understand for the life of me. I understand very clearly if you're using anything as an escape, a bridge outside of poverty. I think that makes total sense for me. I understand the utilization of class mobility, and sometimes you got to do what you got to do. I do not get having a rich dad and not taking my ass to school and not going to Europe and saying, you know what, maybe my spine is good being intact. Hey, maybe I don't want to crash my head into nothing and make it so by the time I'm 50, I could be a different person. Like, I just don't make sense to me, specifically if the dollar is not a part of it.
I will say with the NFL, it's so interesting. If you remember, obviously, Colin and all the drama, and they were like, Goodell was like, we are not involved in politics. He was like, politics is not what we're doing, da 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 da. And then what does he do a week ago? He is up at the White House with Trump. And you're like, oh, this is interesting. And to your point, Miles, people called it everything but race. When we were talking about this stuff, they called it, you know, a conversation about patriotism and blah, blah, blah. And you're like, no, this boils down to the black and white of it all.
Don't go anywhere. More Pod Save the People's coming.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Fast Growing Trees. Did you know that Fast Growing Trees is the biggest online nursery in the U.S. with thousands of different plants and over 2 million happy customers? They have all the plants your yard needs, like fruit trees, privacy trees, flowering trees, shrubs, and a lot more. And the cool thing is that it's not just for the outside. If you want to have some green on the inside, they have what you're looking for too. Whatever plant you're interested in, they got you covered. You can find the perfect fit for your climate and space. And they make it easy to get your dream yard or the dream inside. You can order online and get the plants delivered directly to your door in just a few days. You never have to leave the house. And their Alive and Thrive guarantee ensures that your plants arrive happy and healthy. Plus, get support from trained plant experts on call to help you plan your landscape, choose the right plants, and learn how to care for them. Now, I did not grow up with a green thumb. My grandfather actually planted a lot at grandma's house, and I wish I could say I learned from him, but I didn't. So I need all the help I can get thinking about plants for my house. And that's why the trained plant experts are great, because I can say, hey, this is what the sunlight looks like. This is what the temperature is like in the house. This is the best place I have for the plants, and they can help me figure it out. So whether you have a big yard, small yard, no yard, they have over 6,000 plants to fit any space. From indoor plants to fruit trees, privacy, like full-size privacy trees, like they really do have it all. And there's a 14-point quality checklist to ensure that you're getting the best quality plants possible. And each plant is cared for individually based on their needs, from watering routines to the amount of sunlight, giving your plants the care they deserve from the time they start growing to when they ship in your home. And you can talk to a plant expert like I need to, because I don't know anything about soil, how to take care of plants. Like, I'm starting at zero. I need all the help that I can get. And that's why the Resource Center is also great. If you want to do research on your own, or you can reach out to one of the plant experts. This spring, they have their best deals for your yard or the house, up to half off on select plants and other deals. And listeners to our show get 15% off their first purchase when using the code PSTP at checkout. That's an additional 15% off at fastgrowingtrees.com using code PSTP at checkout. Fastgrowingtrees.com, PSTP. Now's the perfect time to plant. Use PSTP to save today. Offers valid for a limited time. Terms and conditions may apply. Now, before we hop on to the news, we want to give a shout out to the person closest to God on this green earth, our brother, Pope Leo, from the good, great state of Illinois, who may or may not be black. So I just wanted to give a shout out to God for finding our good first American Pope, and wanted to know what your thoughts are about Brother Leo.
One of my friends in the group chat, texted and was like, we have a Creole Pope, right? Like a Creole Pope from the Seventh Ward. And what's funny about it, obviously, is as you all know, like my family is from that part of the country, identifies as Creole, all the things. And they talked to the Pope's brother, who was like, we don't identify as black, right? But the like Pope's maternal grandfather has, you know, records that say he was either born in Haiti or the Dominican Republic. As you know, that depends on what side of the border, same island, right? Or Louisiana. And then they migrated to Chicago when, you know, the home they lived in was, you know, taken over through eminent domain to build to build something. So I think it's an interesting story and an interesting look at passing, right? And I think there's a conversation to be had about, like, once you move from a place and you're divorced from your initial familial and community context, how, depending on how you look, you were able to pass. They did ask the Pope's brother how his mother identified. And he was like, I don't know. She probably would have said she was like Spanish, right? Which is like, not white in 1912, right? But it's, I think that's really interesting. Look, as someone who was raised Catholic, I think it's interesting to think about the church having its first American-born pope in 2,000 years, what that means for what the church is trying to signal about how it wants to engage with the U.S. politically in this moment. Also, choosing a pope who is part of an order that is focused on bridging and bringing people together, right, as part of its sort of ethos and core set of values. So I will be really interested to, you know, to think about that, to follow that, and to hear how those conversations evolve in my family, especially because my family, like a lot of Black people, right, once we know you Black, whether or not you claim us, we claim in you. And so, you know, we're saying special prayers for the Creole Pope.
I'm intercepting those prayers because we need to stop trying to just it feels like we're trying to wring a rock and hopefully a one drop of Black blood yes. comes out like yes. it's just not there yes. let him yes. do that. So my thing with the Pope Leo is his history. I was also fascinated with him being the first American born Pope. I was also curious about what that might signal. It's hard for me to imagine that. Even though I know these decisions are supposed to seem like they just come out of nowhere, it just seems like they're political decisions as well. And then even when Pope Leo's history came out, Pope Leo has talked about not being fond of the homosexual lifestyle, being against homosexual lifestyle, being anti-gender ideology. So that one, listen... I'm kind of used to hearing people say they don't like gay people, or they don't believe in the gay lifestyle, or they don't believe in gay marriage. I count it all as a homophobic rhetoric that you use in order to gain power, including when it's used by a Pope or Obama. I'm like, you trafficked in homophobia to get your power in that moment. I think the same. I think the same thing about this Pope, but the gender ideology stuff kind of gets me because that feels newer. And that makes me worried about us having any type of allyship in the Catholic Church. And it makes me feel like this declaration of him being a pope felt like it might have gotten okay by some people who have touched Trump. I'm not trying to say that they called up Trump and said, is this person okay? And Trump said, are you woke or are you not? But I'm also not saying that either. And I also want to remind people how the Catholic Church is weaponized in the far right. Candace Owens publicly came out as Catholic. And so many far right figures reorientate themselves around this religion because it seems to be the most religious, the most traditional. So it seems as though this Pope selection was affirming that and really telling a lot of different types of far-right individuals, we don't want no smoke. That's what it seems like that decision was for me. I don't have no hope. I don't give grace to popes.
I am interested, though, you know, the comment that people keep referencing about Pope Leo's homophobia is, let me read the full quote. It says, Western mass media is extraordinarily effective in fostering within the general public enormous sympathy for beliefs and practices that are at odds with the gospel. For example, abortion, homosexual lifestyle, euthanasia. That's what he said. The only thing I'd say, and there's nothing I can do to say that that is okay. That is a wild statement to say. And he said it in 2012. And, you know, Pope Francis, whether you liked the last pope or not, Pope Francis was really, really progressive. And in 2020, progressive for the church. He said, homosexuals have a right to be part of the family. They're children of God and have a right to a family. Nobody should be thrown out or be made miserable because of it. And Pope Francis had like a whole... You know, Provence is really progressive. So all I can say is I hope that since 2012, Pope Leo's views have changed and that he comes in the tradition of Pope Francis's progressivism, who, as you know, he had his Pope Mobile converted into a resource for the children of Gaza. So, like, I don't know if, you know, Pope Francis, I think they wanted him to die way sooner than he did because they were like, please stop talking about Gaza every night. So I'm hoping, though, that Pope Leo follows in that tradition.
They come from orders with similar but different orientations around social justice, which I think is also telling. Pope Leo also has publicly said that he, you know, does not agree with J.D. Vance on his stance on immigration, et cetera, et cetera. And while I think Pope Francis was a progressive by the standards of a pope, like as recently as last year, he was saying to people that there was too much faggotry in the Vatican. His word, actually. Pope Francis. He said we cannot have gay men, you know, like trying to train for the priesthood. There's already too much faggotry in the Vatican. I am not kidding. This is an actual quote.
I'm telling you this.
Okay. This is me at my first communion, y'all. I am not kidding. I am Catholic. He said it. Like, so like, yes, right? And in the same way—
He apologized. I'm kidding. Lord. Paul Brandis, look at me up here riding for you, and then you
listen,
up here—
No, he definitely— Yes, okay?
Jesus.
And I'm sorry, I know this is a family podcast. I'm going to stop saying the F word, but that's what he said. And I think it's important to know, in the same way that like people will say that they believe that women deserve the opportunity to fully participate in the church, but also don't believe that women deserve to hold the priesthood or to be ministers, et cetera, right? Like the Pope still saw limits on how gay people and how trans people were to be treated in the church, right? Like he believed they were to be welcomed and their humanity was to be seen, but like he wasn't going to marry us, you know, like he wasn't going to do that. And so while I think there was like a step forward, I also want us to be realistic about how far forward that step was.
That's so interesting. Thank you for letting me know that, because I did not know that detail, because, you know, I try to be kind, so it could always be fuck anybody who...
Pope Francis did support civil union, Sharonda, just to put that out there.
That is not the sacrament of marriage in Catholicism. I just want to be very clear, right?
You're right.
He's render unto Caesar what is Caesar's, and you can have a civil union. Render unto the Lord what is the Lord's, and that is a marriage, and he is drawing a distinction between the two.
Pope Francis, you got me out here looking crazy up here.
It does make me think about... That's just really interesting, Sharonda. And it almost makes me even more solid on my, and just that kind of call to have more just like solid oppositional stances to conservative institutions. And not to offend anybody, specifically not Sharonda, but like to offend anybody who's a part of those conservative institutions. But it just reaffirms to me that there could be a more liberal progressive costume these institutions will put on. But as far as the inner workings really progressing, it's just not happening. And I think in a moment like this, because what we really need to know is right now, because America is where it's at and the world is where it's at, do you have a clear moral compass that includes queer people, that includes trans people, that includes immigrants, you know? Because if you're shaky on one thing or back and forth on one thing, you could be on other things too. Like, do you have that? And it just seems like, no, these conservative institutions are like, no, we're gonna protect the empire first. Don't get that wrong, doll.
Yeah. The thing I'll say about the Catholic Church's stance on immigration is that particularly in the United States, immigrants form the bedrock of Catholicism right now. And so, you know, the Catholic Church is really always stands in strong support of immigrants and in strong opposition to this current administration, in particular, their actions targeting immigrants. But speaking of immigrants and refugees, my news this week is about the Trump administration bringing a group of 60 Afrikaners, so white South Africans, to the United States as refugees, despite having suspended other refugee resettlement programs. And part of the reason for this is that, according to the administration, the South African government, in an attempt to sort of reallocate resources that were hoarded during the apartheid period, is engaging in racial discrimination against a class of people based on their race. right? And so they're like, these people are being persecuted by their government and we should bring them here. As a reminder, Elon Musk is a white South African person. He is an Afrikaner. And so I don't think we can miss that connection. But I wanted to bring into the pod, one, because I think this decision in and of itself is interesting, but two, because I also feel like it is emblematic of what this this administration has started doing, which is like perverting a law or perverting a policy from its original intent, right? And pretending to only be able to read like the literal interpretation of it and enforcing it or leveraging it in a way that is opposite from its initial intent. And I just thought, you know, referring to wealthy white landowners from a country where they are the racial minority, have hoarded access for generations, where 30 years after the official end of apartheid, you know, Black South Africaners have an average of like, I think 5% of the median wealth of like white South Africaners. And I just thought like, wow, like again, here they go, you know? So wanted to bring it to the pod for discussion.
The term that came to me was global white supremacist solidarity. I think about that even with like Ukraine, like when you study more and more about like Ukraine and see, oh, there's anti-Blackness there, you know, and we, and as much as we might have our thoughts about what should happen in Ukraine, just as humans, we also specifically, if you're a Black person, have to know that these places that maybe you're advocating for are not places that welcome Blackness or have, they have anti-Black sentiment. And, just to connect that to this story, I see all these things as like a kind of, as almost like a global circuit board trying to make it so the white supremacist ideology can be connected. And so it could be supported in a way that is not localized, in a way that is not, oh, that's just South Africa's problem, or that's just Ukraine's problem, or that's just Israel's problem, or that's just America's problem. It becomes a global problem. So we're seeing white supremacist global solidarity happen. And to me, that's a little bit scary, where, oh, you're doing well in South Africa and you want to come to America as a refugee, we'll create space for that. We'll create a pathway for that, because it's no longer, and let's be real, it never was about doing what's right. It's about what can we do to maintain and grow and protect whiteness and the power of whiteness, specifically in a new digital age. And yeah, this we talk about borderless societies and societies with no borders. It seems like the white supremacists have planned their own borderless society, whereas as long as you're white, there can be support in sharing of power.
Yeah, the only thing I have to say to this is that this is only possible when you completely decimate the media landscape in all forms, because I do think there's a base of enough people who will be like, yeah, all this, I think about this with ICE, I think about this with certainly Israel and Palestine, I think about a lot of what Trump is doing, like, wouldn't work if Twitter wasn't a mess, if TikTok, you know, one of the reasons why the TikTok algorithm changed was precisely because of the videos about Palestine and Gaza. Fox News is, you know, a nightmare. And he is, even if he doesn't take away the money from places like PBS and NPR, like take away all their money, he creates a chilling effect where people are, yes, like, well, if I say this, then the FAA might da-da-da-da-da. Or, I mean, the FTC, Lord, the FAA is also a nightmare because what's going on in Newark, everybody. But the FTC might wage some sort of political moment. And, you know, it's why I can test when people, I both agree, Miles brought this up earlier. I agree with this idea that there is a group of people who support all of these things. I think that's true. And I won't dismiss that. I think you can't get to Trump part two if not for that. And I think there's a bigger group of people who don't know what up from down is, not because they don't want to know, but because the landscape is literally just a different place. And that's how I think about this. But I will use that to segue into my news around ICE. I don't know if you saw, but Ross Baraka, the mayor of Newark and the son of the famed Amiri Baraka, the poet, who is also, Ross is running for governor of New Jersey.
Thought you were going to say was also on the interludes on the Lauryn Hill, Miseducation of Lauryn Hill album.
Was also on the interludes on the album. Shout out to Lauryn Hill, classic. And he was at the ICE facility that is in Newark alongside other alongside members of Congress. Newark did not want this ICE facility there, but they were going to go check out the facility. Though he is not a member of Congress, he was surrounded by members of Congress. Members of Congress do have the legal right to enter any ICE facility without a appointment at any time. Many people have exercised this right. They also can enter into other federal facilities. If you remember, a lot of Congress people on the right visited people who were incarcerated as the January 6th crew. So like they, you know, the right has exercised this right before. So Ross gets arrested and everybody's like, y'all done arrested the mayor of Newark, which is really wild. When you look at the video, they're saying that he like shoved people, He did not do that. But the Department of Homeland Security, which manages ICE, is also now saying that they are considering arresting Representatives Bonnie Watson Coleman, LaMonica McIver, and Rob Menendez. And I bring this up because for a couple reasons. One is that what ICE is doing is wild. We knew ICE was wild. ICE continues to be wild. It is interesting to see the Congress who will be like, ICE is wild. You're like, yeah, okay. ICE has been crazy, and we don't have control of Congress to rein ICE in, which is really the challenge. And Kristi Noem, who's, I won't even say out loud that she's running the Department of Homeland Security, but the person who is in that role, Kristi, is just hanging out in office. So there's that. But the second thing that this made me think of is, you know, and I say, you know, I'm a card-carrying member of the far left in many ways, obviously from the protests and blah, blah, blah. But I think about how much we owe to the people who see the problem and say it out loud before it is cool to do. And I think about, like, that's not even a shout out to myself because I didn't even know what ICE was when the police killed Mike Brown in 2014. But I think about the people who were like, abolish ICE really early. They were really clear about it. They were like, ICE doesn't work. Don't scale it back. Don't try and make it better. Don't, you know, the only thing, we don't organize around ICE. We focus on the other 19,000, the local police departments. But what I did know about ICE is that ICE and Border Patrol kill. Border Patrol is the largest police department in the United States, larger than any local police agency. But Border Patrol kills a fair number of people across the American border every year, and they don't have to report it because the people are not in America. So we know the shootings happen, and we have some rough numbers, but we don't know names. So that was something we were working on. But anyway, I think about how little credit the, I don't even want to say just activists, but like the furthest people from the center on the left, like they don't get the credit for calling out so many things that so many people benefit from. And ICE is one of them that like, you know, I'm watching these Congress people talk about how wild ICE is. And I'm sitting here like, you were the same person saying that like people were crazy for talking about ICE. And I hate to even say this, but to see that the Democrats expanded, you're like, yo, I can't defend it. I don't know what to say. You know, normally I can ride with some stuff, but this doesn't make sense. But I think about that with housing. I think about that with voter ID. I think about that with a lot of issues on the left, education, where like it was the far left people that people call crazy who forced an issue and would not let it go that created the space that people now think is normal. And I just want to shout out all of the people who carried Abolish ICE for so long.
The other, one of the reasons why the things that happen on the far left don't gain steam is because Democrats don't want it to gain steam. Like in order to, when you really talk about anything from bell hooks to Marxism, you know, like Marxism, any of those kind of far left in air quotes ideas and theories, it is about unraveling institutions. It is about unraveling conservative pathways to domination. And when you challenge that, the people who benefit from it staying intact are going to be slow to recognize it or are going to actively make it so the things that you're called, they're going to actively make it seem like you're crazy. Like the split that we see in the Democratic Party or in the left, I should say, is produced. It's not natural. It was produced. It was people saying, well, you don't want to be that kind of left. Like, maybe you'll put a pussy hat on and you'll talk about some things that are happening in Hollywood and you'll put a protest sign up at the Met Gala because that's going to do something. But you'll do that, but you're not actually going to traffic in the ideas or in the people who are talking about abolishing things or talking about unraveling things, you know, and asking, are these things, are prisons obsolete? You know, abolish ICE. Like, I think it was designed that way. That's what, to me, on a daily basis, makes me sad, is that I don't have a warm rendering of the people who decided to silence people who are on the far left. I think it was on purpose. I think it was to maintain power and to make it so now. I think the idea was Democrats would be able to run as new Republicans while still seeming progressive, while still taking conservative money. I think that was the game plan. And I think they thought that COVID and Trump and all this stuff were such hard hits that no matter what we decide to produce, you gonna vote for it. And, you know, we see that didn't work. But that's what makes me sad, is that it doesn't feel like a mistake. It feels like steps towards something.
Yeah, I live in Los Angeles. I have spent a lot of time crossing the border myself. Also, like, you know, as a teenager, we just like literally would go across the border as a thing. And so I think about the privilege I have, like moving back and forth across the border as a person with a US passport. And I think about the very real terrorism that people are experiencing in this moment in the name of, like, quote unquote, keeping us safe. And, you know, I was in DC last week when, you know, ICE was targeting delivery drivers. And I have a friend of mine who is a Black immigrant and a parent, and knew that this was happening. And when she went to go pick her kid up from school, all of his teachers had lined up to like make sure that he made it to her car safely because they just weren't sure, you know? And I think in listening to some of this conversation, I think, and listening to Miles talk about, you know, their perception that what we are doing is creating these intentional wedges on the left to the extent that one exists in the US. I think an additional wedge is having the face of immigration in this country be only Latino, right? So that those of us who are Black are also not thinking about the ways in which immigration enforcement and this kind of terrorism also impacts us and people who look like us and share our surnames and our faiths and all of that other stuff. But abolish ICE, you know, to your point, DeRay, I do think felt pretty radical, because I think for most of us, and I'll speak for myself as a millennial here, right, came to be aware of like immigration enforcement and ICE in the era of like the Patriot Act and like a post 9/11 world, where we were all so willing to give up so much in the name of security, right? And I think we are seeing, you know, that those folks planted seeds that are now bearing fruit in this way. And I think this is a moment for, you know, people who are reasonable and rational, and I think that will include some political moderates, to think about how we fix our immigration system, because I also feel like people don't understand how hard it is to actually become a U.S. citizen. Like, you, it's like, it's one of the hardest things ever. There's no clear pathway. And so, yeah, I think I just feel in my personal life and my professional life and the city I live in and the cities that I visit, just this overall sense of just like, there's a pall over all of us because of the behavior of ICE and ICE agents. I don't know if that even made sense, but it's the set of reflections that are sitting with me.
Can I ask a question? Do you all think, because, you know, I'm a creative thinker, so sometimes I have to be my own bridge between conspiratorial and likely to happen. So I was thinking about how many Black people, specifically older Black people, mostly older Black people, who don't have birth certificates, right? And when I was looking at this like ICE thing and thinking about
the real ID stuff.
The real ID, but also I'm thinking, that's true when it comes to travel, but I'm also thinking if certain types of numbers are what makes somebody a US citizen. So aren't we just a couple of steps away from it being, if you don't have a birth certificate, if you don't have a social security number here, you're not a U.S. citizen. And couldn't that begin to include some of our elderly Black folks who been here since chattel slavery, but who don't have certain types. I say that because I know I have family who don't have those type of paperworks, who have relaxed and say, I'll never travel. That's okay. The Lord let me see tomorrow. I don't need to see Paris. And they're cool with it, but they don't have any of this paperwork. And could those identities go from invisible like they are now to criminal? Is that a logical pathway, or is that a little too tinfoil?
I think it's totally logical. I mean, my grandfather has two different spellings of his last name, one on his birth certificate. And then he went to school and the teacher asked him, what's his name? And he said, I'm Norris Bossier. And the teacher wrote it as Bossier. His parents were sharecroppers who were not literate. They were like, the teacher must be right. So that's how we're going to spell it. And his death certificate has a different spelling of his last name, you know? And so I even just like stuff like that, right? Like one person's lifetime because of a host of reasons and factors. I think we all are in danger. Even me, right? Like I was adopted by my grandparents. And so that's why I have my grandfather's last name. But like I have a different version of a birth certificate, right? Like I have a birth certificate that says that I was born in 1984. I have a birth certificate that says my mother was born in 1932. And I have a birth certificate that says I have a mother who was born in 1958. You know what I mean? And like there are different things that, to your point, like we reissue documents, we lose documents, we make errors on documents. I think most of us are too sure that we are not going to be targeted in this way. And I think, again, another bridge building opportunity.
I don't know if you saw the videos, but the quote, ICE agents are wearing masks. So you don't know who's arresting who. ICE has recently, since Trump got in office, has increased by 10,000 people. And there are reports that say that these are the Proud Boys, that they are just getting white supremacists like very explicitly to all these roles, which is why they are covering their faces and da-da-da. And it just is sort of like, where does this end? And then the second is that people are already posing as ICE agents because they're masking. They're already posing as ICE agents and targeting women. And people are complying with them because they think they're agents, and then they're getting assaulted. And you're like, well, there's no good ending to this.
Hey, you're listening to Pod Save the People. Stay tuned. There's more to come.
Pod Save the People is brought to you by Magic Spoon. Now, I love Magic Spoon, and the reason I love Magic Spoon is that as I was trying to think about my fitness journey, I have had to be more thoughtful about what I eat. And I'll tell you, the protein piece of it all is something that I wasn't very good at. I didn't really know anything about protein before I started going to the gym in the past couple of years. Like, I just didn't know. I didn't know anything about like a wholesome diet. Like, I had no clue. And in trying to find snacks that tasted good and had the protein I needed, there weren't a lot of great things out there, but that's how I got to Magic Spoon. Because Magic Spoon makes high protein, zero sugar cereal and treats that are reinvented from your childhood. And I grew up loving cereal, and now it's just too much sugar and stuff in it. But that's where Magic Spoon comes in, because this is zero sugar and high protein. And the cool thing is that Magic Spoon is also launching a brand new high-protein granola, snack on the go. And true to the Magic Spoon promise, it's packed with protein and it's crunchy. There are also the Magic Spoon high-protein treats, and they're crispy, crunchy, airy, and an easy way to get 12 grams of protein on the go. They come in mouth-watering flavors like marshmallow, chocolate peanut butter, and dark chocolate. And like I said, with the granola, which is brand new, the granola packs have 13 grams of protein and zero added sugars. They come in delicious flavors like dark chocolate almond, honey almond, and peanut butter. I'm telling you, you need to get on Magic Spoon. I have one every day. They are thebomb.com. Get $5 off your next order at magicspoon.com/people or look for Magic Spoon on Amazon or your nearest grocery store. That's magicspoon.com/people for $5 off.
Now I gotta talk about Beyonce.
It's Sage. Sage is on out.
Okay. Let me go ahead and say the things I have to say before I speak about Beyonce. I love Beyonce. I think Beyonce is one of the most genius Black performers we've ever seen. I believe that her She has been a performing crystal ball, meaning she's been able to transfer different eras, different molds of Black womanhood and in artistry to these different eras. And I think we have not seen somebody with her cultural power, which is how come I always feel compelled to engage with her in this way, because I think her work is, and her performance is smart enough to be engaged in this way. So I remember back in the day when I was stuck between a Bell Hooks and a Beyoncé plays, and Bell Hooks was critiquing Beyoncé, and I was maybe the most excited about a Beyoncé project that I've ever been. I'm speaking about Lemonade, because here she was referencing Daughter of the Dust. Here she was genre hopping. Here she was doing Southern Gothic womanist folklore, and it was just really great and terrific. And of course, Bell had her critiques. And one thing that always stuck with me, even if I didn't or don't agree with everything Bell Hooks says, one thing that always stuck with me is the fact that at the end of the day, this is for mass consumption. This is for entertainment. And no matter where you are positioned in that, when you decide to dance with that mass consumption monster, you have performed being a race traitor. That is just the function of that. And I think that us as Black people, we all participate in it. We all do that. A black man does not own Crooked. So again, I don't mean to say that as if I'm some type of saint. But I wanted to connect those moments of critique of Beyoncé and mass consumption and creating these kind of Black womanist Southern Gothic folklore for mass consumption, and that critique that Bell Hooks had. I wanted to bridge that to the Cowboy Carter era, because here I am in this Cowboy Carter era and kind of released Beyoncé to saying, well, you know what? Maybe she learned from the Black Panther stuff and the womanist stuff. And she's like, listen, I'm going to give y'all some Afro beats. I'm going to give y'all some affirmations, some spiritual stuff that I like to do, but I'm not necessarily going to evoke revolutionary ideas through my performance while I'm also marrying it to commercial consumption. So even thinking about her Black Panther performance, that was one of my favorite performances of her at Super Bowl, me thinking about what does it mean for a Black woman with so much power to create a spectacle out of real Black revolutionary aesthetic and work? What does that mean? And I think we all, and so many artists, try to play with that and try to see what they can do and try to find their way. And I kind of thought that's what Beyoncé was doing. But I have to be really honest with y'all. As I was watching the Cowboy Carter video footage, I was disturbed. I was disturbed at the idea that Beyoncé says revolution in one of her songs and she uses Jill Scott Heron's "The Revolution Won't Be Televised." And it's not just her use of it. It's that by the conclusion of the whole show, it collapses into a Levi's commercial. It collapses into a brown liquor commercial. And I think silence is so useful. I think just showing something is so useful. I think here in 2025 and what we're facing right now and what's going on right now and what the state of the Black community is right now at large, I'm not just talking about the liberal elites that I love so much. I'm talking about all Black people. That feels like a really stupid thing to do. It really feels unfair to see somebody with so much power be able to use revolutionary talk, revolutionary ideas, the idea that our revolution will happen, A, on the inside, will A, not happen with the gaze of white surveillance, and then also will not be an assistance to commercial gain. So even in the actual poem, he goes on to talk about it won't be for Colgate, it won't come on commercials. He'll say all that stuff. And I just don't understand what it means for a person with so much power and influence and talent as Beyoncé, and also to me what it seems like a real love for Black people in the Black community. I don't understand what it means to utilize something that is so sacred and pervert it and empty it and flatten it. And to me, that is the thing that feels the most disrespectful to me at all times. It's not if a pop star uses revolutionary talk or an outfit, it's the fact that once you bring Jill Scott-Heron to Levi's, it just becomes another voice and another color that Levi's can use in order to recreate its own profit. Once you bring Black Panther costumes to the Super Bowl field, it just becomes Halloween costumes and spectacle, and it flattens the individuality and the self-determination that Black Panthers wanted to do. And I think maybe because we're in the post-Met Gala world, because we're in this world where I feel like so many Black superstars are just unraveling in front of us, like even Doechii, who I love, I'm seeing that she's just kind of just publicly unraveling. Just it seems like nothing's sticking. But I also think it's because our waters aren't deep enough. Our honey is not sticky enough. Our rhetoric and ideas around revolution are not solid enough. And I think it's creating these really weird minstrelly collages of what we think revolution should be, as long as Colgate says it's okay. As long as Levi says it's okay. And it loses its teeth and it feels disrespectful. And these are the times where I wish silence wasn't the medium of Beyonce, but articulation was. What say you?
That was quite a lot. That felt like a text in so many places to plug in. I think I feel like you said a lot that, you know, I agree with, chiefly the point around, like, once you've reached a certain point, you almost inevitably are either a race or a class traitor, right? Like, I think that's just inherent. Like, you don't become a billionaire, right? Without those things, right? Or having stepped on a couple of people to get there, let's just say that, right? I think what is interesting, and I think what a lot of people have wrestled with, particularly around Cowboy Carter, is the claims around this being about a reclaiming of the images and imagery of Americana, right? And I think also bumping up against the limitations of that, right? Like, you can only do so much with blonde hair, a cowboy hat, and an American flag if you are still not white, you know? And honestly, for me, the first moment I felt, I enjoy Beyonce for who she is, right? Like, she's going to put on a show. She's a consummate performer. She's going to give me some stuff to, you know, sing along to. I'm going to feel like a baddie as I'm getting ready to go out if I'm playing Beyonce while I'm doing my makeup, right? I don't necessarily engage with her in the way that I think a lot of people do, as like the sort of cultural bellwether or touchstone. But I will say that a challenge that I had with Beyonce recently was actually around Renaissance, and actually around what felt like the co-op of queer culture and ballroom culture, right? And I think I had a great time at the show, right? Like, for real, a great time. And I also am like, you know, Beyonce had been really quiet on gay and queer rights for a long time, even knowing, like, you know, the composition of her fan base, right? And then it's like, then she shows up. It's kind of like the Pope and his blackness, right? Like, we get a little glimmer of it.
Obama, right? Obama in the nose. Everybody was like, I don't know about no gay. Y'all could dance behind me, but I don't know about that right now. Bush is in office.
And I think we just have to, I think this is also, you know, a point I was trying to make last week about Black people attending the Met Gala, right? Which is like, sometimes the shit is just entertaining. And like, that's it. And I think the clearer we can be on that, and the more that we can stop trying to hang all of our hopes and all of our expectations around people's politic because of the art that they create, I think the less disappointed we will all be. And to your point of being stuck between like a bell hooks and a Beyonce, it's like, Beyonce has never told you she wanted to be your cultural or pop culture bell hook. She's never said that, right? She's like, I'm here, I make art, I do my thing, I do a thing that speaks to me in this moment, and then I move on. And I think that, you know, part of celebrity culture in this moment is about us projecting onto people what we want from them. And I think Beyonce has demonstrated that, like, she didn't ask to take on that responsibility and she doesn't want it.
Sister Sharonda.
Yes. Yes.
I would normally, because I was there when it came to Renaissance. I said, you know what? I hear you, B. You said, listen, I gave you this thing with my husband. I give you all this imagery, pro-Black. I'm Renaissance. I'm gay. I'm Black. There's white dancers here. There's gay dancers. It's new. I'm updated. It's whatever. I do think it's something different when you decide to put Jill Scott-Heron in your world tour today in 2025. I think it's a different thing. And I do believe in just this one thing around entertainment. This the only reason I'm saying this now because this is about the second or third time I heard you say it, and I do deeply disagree with that. I think that entertainment has been the medium of so much liberation, so much work, so much that has been the medium of Black folks to not just escape certain types of class positions, but then also to communicate other things to other Black people, down to the Negro spiritual, down to the gospel, down to Sounds of Blackness talking about optimistic, down to Beyonce telling us that she runs the world, or the things that she said during formation and the images that she created during formation. I think that there is nothing more political in America than entertainment. I think that that is baseball, apple pie, entertainment. And I think anytime you engage with that, you are in a fully fledged 100% political relationship, and there's no getting around with it. You cannot be a Black person and go to the Met Gala and that not be political. You can pretend it's not, but it is. And you cannot be a Black person and go to LA and play Jill Scott Heron and say, but it's not political, I'm just having fun.
I don't disagree with you about the impact of entertainment, right? I'm saying I think we have to acknowledge that that lane has been co-opted, right? Mm. That I think is that what I'm saying. I think we have to acknowledge that it's been bought and sponsored. Right? Mm-hmm. That's more the point. So thank you for pushing me on that. But I think that's more the point that I'm trying to make, which is like, I think we have to start saying to ourselves, like, we have to start compartmentalizing for ourselves and figure out what that new lane is. Because, you know, one of the reasons I went to college, quite honestly, was because I wanted to be Claire Huxtable. Like, that is, mm-hmm. that's what I wanted. And I only saw Claire Huxtable because of the Cosby Show, right? Like, I didn't have professional Black women in my immediate circle or in my immediate world around me. And so I held on to that. You know, so I hear you on the like power of those images and the power of those stories and the power of those characters. But I am saying I also recognize that, to your point, when it's going to be sponsored by Levi's, there are limitations. And so I've got to start looking somewhere else so that I am not disappointing myself.
So I guess my final question to you, and DeRay, if you want to answer, Cheryl. But like, but I guess like my final like question is then, what should we consider the enlightened artist who understands and uses the colors of Blackness, the colors of aesthetic radicalism, like Jill Scott Heron produced the words, all these different things to evoke something just for their own commercial gain? What do we call an artist who does that? Not just Beyonce. I'm talking about any artist who says, you know what? I'm not just going to sit here and dance and be cute. I'm not going to just be, let's say, Cardi B or Meg Thee Stallion, who are great and they're just here for entertainment. I'm actually going to use your grief, use your history, in order to entice you for my own commercial gaining and for the own recreation of my own stardom and profit. What do you call a person like that? What do you call that? Is what I'm thinking.
I think those people are like Marian sinners, right? I think
we call them Marys.
I think you invite them in and they bring the other bad spirits with them. I think they're Trojan horses.
So Malcolm says, show me in the white community where a trumpet player is a leader. He said, they are just pumpets. you know, this makes me, I echo, I love the conversation you two just had that has pushed me in a lot of ways. I will say, this makes me think of Reconstruction. And I know we've talked about this at some point on the pod, because I've obviously been on the pod since the beginning. So I know it's something we've talked about. But, you know, I think Reconstruction to me is such a brilliant moment of study, because there's arguably no time in American history where Black people were politically more represented, had more money, were economically strong, like had all the things. And one day white people woke up and said enough and took it all back. And we have not had the political power, the economic stability, any of that stuff since the end of Reconstruction. And you know, one of the things that happens when you get Black wealth and Black power is there are a set of people who believe that that money and that whatever will be a salve against white supremacy with a capital W and a capital S. And if there's anybody in this moment who people should be looking at like, Yeah, say what you will about that money you got. Trump will come in and ICE will be at Beyonce's door. Like, he does not care. I think, you know, like, it. I think that celebrity and economic power will not save people that celebrity and economic power might have saved before. I think that we are at the fever pitch of white supremacy in this political moment. And I am worried about our entertainers and other people who... You either get the Saquons cozying up to Trump, or you just get people who are like, I don't do politics. And I think the cost of this in this moment is going to be really deep. I hear, Miles, you seem to be saying that, like, Beyonce is doing politics by putting Jill Scott Heron in the work.
I was going to say... I hear everything you're saying about the entertainment piece and stuff like that, and I follow that. But I'm like, well, didn't Vice President Harris tap her on her shoulder? Didn't she sing at two inaugurations? As did Meg Thee Stallion. So I think my thing is the separation from entertainment and politics. Even if I don't really believe it, it will be easier for me to say, like, you know what, I'm going to Dolly Parton this thing out, and you'll kind of get where my politics are based off of maybe some things I participate in. But I don't get the wielding of it. I don't get the, even though I'm going to be apolitical, I'm still going to use certain things to entice you. And then also, when it was time to use your power for something political, you did it and you gave it to the Democratic Party. And then everything becomes that, because you not saying Free Gaza becomes something, because you will say, vote for this person. So it's not like you're apolitical.
What do you say to the people who, though, are like, I just don't know enough? What do you say? Like, I could see, clearly I'm not talking to Beyonce. I don't have Beyonce's number, so I'm saying this in jest. But, like, I could see Beyonce saying, like, I don't know enough about Palestine and Israel to, like, make a declarative statement. But of the two choices, Trump and Kamala, like, Trump is crazy and I'm, you know, like, I'm supporting her. That feels like a legitimate position that I think a lot of, that feels like a legitimate calculus that I think a lot of people are making who are entertainers.
That makes sense to me. I think my push would be, at this point where we are in 2025 with this fever pitch, I don't think we're at the fever pitch. I think it's really freaking hot, but I actually think it could get hotter. So I don't think we're at that fever pitch of it. I think that if you have money, if you have a dollar, if you got a space to sit down and read, if you got access to thriftbooks.com, if you got access to a library while you can, go read about it. Because if you have that much money to have the gift of solitude, the gift of reflection, the gift of conversation, there's no artist, even if I don't really like you, I'm not the hugest, I'm 34 now. Like, I'm not the hugest Megan Thee Stallion, Cardi B person. If somebody said, hey, Cardi B wants to say something, and this has happened to me before, if an artist says, hey, I want to understand something because I want to talk about it, that's what you should do. Because if you have the whole world looking at you, you will still take Palestinian money, right? You would still take this global economy and use it to your advantage to help yourself, right? So why not educate yourself too, specifically when you're so resourced? And again, not just talking about Beyonce, talking about anybody who got a lot of money.
Sharonda, do you buy that? I'm trying to understand, like, because I can see people, and Miles, thank you for that. I can see people both saying, I don't understand the issue well enough to talk about it. It feels really complicated. And the, like, to what end do I, like, how many of the things do I need to make statements on? Is it the police? Is it healthcare? Is it the, like, sort of where do I, because that's what I actually think people are contending with in the background. I'm not excusing it. I do think that is what people are saying.
I do hear you, DeRay, on the, like, I don't know enough, which does feel like a little bit of a cop-out, because if people want to know something, they have the resources to find out about it, right? And to, like, ask people to... I just think that people are making a different calculation around what is at risk for them if they were to say something. And they are deciding that they want to protect whatever it is they have, and that whatever that other thing is. And, like, you know, support for Kamala was pretty middle of the road. You know what I mean? And I think it's pretty widely understood that in this country, you have two options when it comes to a president, and like, you pick one. And, like, for Beyonce, the support of Kamala is like an extension of her brand as, like, rah-rah Black woman. Right. So that felt like logical and in keeping with, like, the public brand and persona that she has created and curated. I think you know, I think what I'm wrestling with is like, what do we do when I think we are so wanting for public intellectuals in this moment, and the only ones we seem to have to turn to are people who are celebrities, right?
Ding ding ding.
And
ding,
that
ding,
is I'm that's give you that. What I'm thinking about right now.
Yeah, but and also it's a Black imagination problem, right? Because these are also, even if we don't want Beyonce to go ahead and debate or whatever, I don't think I'm suggesting that, but I do want to say that there is some type of to me feels more like an imagination lapse, because I'm like, the right seems to be able to figure out barstool productions and all these different things. Like, why is that not the way that we think about things?
Yeah. And in LA, last thing I'll say is, you know, we've had people with connections here create community salon spaces, right? Where like, even if they aren't the people who are doing the talking or the teaching themselves, they are leveraging their celebrity, their access, their name recognition to pull people together. And I think that is a missed opportunity.
Well, that's it. Thanks so much for tuning in to Pod Save the People this week. And don't forget to follow us at Pod Save the People and Crooked Media on Instagram, Twitter, and TikTok. And if you enjoyed this episode of Pod Save the People, consider dropping us a review on your favorite podcast app. And we will see you next week. Pod Save the People is a production of Crooked Media. It's produced by Adrian Moultrie and mixed by Charlotte Landis. Executive produced by me, and special thanks to our weekly contributors, Miles E. Johnson and Sharon DeBossier. Our production staff is proudly unionized with the Writers Guild of America East.
Save on quality sofas, sectionals, top brand mattresses, and more during Haverty's President's Day sale. Find the style of furniture you've been looking for at Haverty's, online or in Columbus at Polaris.
You ain't heard about Moto Casino? Moto has real Vegas slots. Any game you can find on the floor in Vegas, you can play it on Moto. I like my slots hot. Moto's free to play, like food stamps, in line at the grocery store, at a funeral, in traffic. Keep your eyes on the road. Hop on Moto Casino. Moto Casino got jackpots that are bigger than my belly. Moto, America's hottest free-to-play social casino.
Download the Moto Casino app today.
Moto Casino is a social casino. Void where prohibited. No purchase necessary. Visit moto.us for more details.
Moto Casino. America's social casino.